still remember the first time I met someone. I'm not going to lie, but I spent some time with them, and we got along okay. I mean, not the best of friends, but he came over to my house, and he acted very odd in my house. I don't know, just not the way my other friends acted. And after he left, I remember my mother saying to me that she didn't want me to spend a lot of time with this person. I asked why, and I think there was something along the phrase that I don't want you to run with the wrong crowd. It was the turn of phrase that really fascinated me, this running with the wrong crowd. It sounded very exhausting, like I had joined a cross-country team that didn't stop or something. I don't know, it was kind of odd to me. The other one that fascinates me, of course, is you don't want to fall in with the wrong crowd. And that sounds even more terrifying, because now it sounds like you've gone skydiving with people you're not supposed to spend time with. It's kind of a strange sort of situation to find yourself in. And yet, the thing that fascinates me more and more is that while our parents try and do this for us as we grow up, as we become adults, who tells us that? Who actually tries to intercede and tell us that they're concerned that we're joining the wrong cross-country team or the wrong skydiving event? In so many ways, who is it that says to us that they are concerned that we are with the wrong crowd? It becomes an interesting point to me in so many ways, especially when we come to these readings. I mean, if you consider for a moment, we have Isaiah. And Isaiah is in the temple. He sees God himself seated in the temple. And he fills the whole space. Literally his train, the fabric of his garment that bleeds out behind him, fills the whole void. It fills the whole space. It is this massive, enormous filling. Surrounding him are seraphim angels, these incredible, remarkable angels who spend their entire lives in adoration nearest to God himself. And his first thought is not, now God's going to tell me what he wants for my life. Finally, I get the revelation and everything else will be figured out in my life. No, the first thing that he thinks of is, I'm going to die. Because I am an unclean man, living with unclean people, in an unclean place. Really, if you change it out, you could actually be sinful. I'm a sinful man, living in a sinful world, surrounded by sinful people. I don't deserve to see the face of God. In fact, I shouldn't actually be here. And it's that remarkable moment where he actually comes face to face with his own limitation that Isaiah isn't stacking things on, he isn't making things up. He's actually exemplifying humility in so many ways because he has an honest moment with himself. He has this honest moment with himself where he looks at himself and he says, I'm not supposed to be here. And yet God brought me here. He doesn't run out. I know it's a vision, so how would he run out? But he doesn't even try and make an escape. He stands in sight of God, amazed that God has brought him to this moment. And the most terrifying thing of all, seraphim takes a burning ember and touches his lips with it. Remember, not even the seraphim want to touch the ember because they grab their tongs and they come down and they touch his lips with the burning ember, which, I don't care how many ways you want to rephrase that, still sounds incredibly painful. And he says, see, you are made clean. Not that being made clean is a simple process, a wave of the hand and suddenly we feel all better, but perhaps sometimes it can be as terrifyingly painful as a burning ember touching our lips. And in that moment, he realizes that while he may not himself consider himself ready to do this, while he himself recognizes that he is not actually the clean one he should be, because he is made clean in the sight of God, God asks, who will I send? It's that terrifying moment. That invitation to a calling. Who will I send out? Who will go out for me to preach to these unclean people? Who will step into this unclean world and be a witness to something greater? It's fascinating because consider for a moment that we jump forward to Luke. And I love this moment because we have Simon, who will later be called Peter. So I'll call him Peter Rabbi, even though we call him Simon. Simon Peter is Peter. We have a teacher by the lake. And there are some fishermen ending their day. And I know they're ending their day because later it'll say, we were up all night fishing, we caught nothing. We put in a full day's work, but we didn't catch anything. They put in a full day. They're at the end of their work day. They're mooring the boats, they're cleaning the nets, they're doing end of the workday, finish up things so they get called. And this teacher, this popular guy, steps into the boat and says, "Put out from shore." And I wonder what goes through Peter's mind at that moment. I wonder what it's like for Peter at that moment to think, "Yeah, sure, you know, I've got nothing better to do. I just wanted to go to sleep. But, you know, we can sleep when we're dead, right? So we'll just put out to shore. That sounds like fun." And he begins to teach the people. And I want to know what Peter was doing during that time. Did he sit and listen? Did he try and sleep? Did he just busy himself around the boat trying to pretend he had something he had to get done while he was out there so that he could sort of have that cover of guys that he could busy himself with something while this man taught from his boat? I don't know how long he preached. Could have been hours. I doubt it was 10 minutes or less. So, you know, definitely not a regular day homily anymore, but, you know, somewhere there. And then this guy, this teacher, this one who apparently can tell him what to do and just go around telling people how they should live their lives, looks at this fisherman and says, "I'm going to tell you how to fish." I know, they use different words, but that's actually what happens, because he says, "Put out in the deep, throw down your nets for a catch." Really? You're not even a fisherman. Now you're going to tell me how to do my job? Put out into deep water. Step out for a moment with God. And allow God to speak in that moment to you. And for whatever reason, maybe Peter wants to humor him. Maybe Peter sees something more he just can't quite put his finger on. He does exactly what he asks. He says, "Look, I do this for a living and I didn't catch anything last night, but you said so. I'll give it a shot." The most remarkable thing happens. And I don't mean to catch a fish. The most remarkable thing happens because for that brief moment, Peter comes face to face with the reality of who he is in his life and as he relates to the people around him. He gets to come face to face with the life that he is living and how it's not the life he knows he should be living. Because trust me, no one who is proud of the life that they are living suddenly bends down to his knees and says, "Leave me, for I am a sinful man." He came face to face with the Almighty, and he actually comes face to face with his own limitations, and he has this profound moment of humility because he knows who he is and where he lives in the world. And he falls to his knees and begs him, "Leave me, for I am a sinful man." But he doesn't. Jesus doesn't say, "Oh, well, I tried," and he heads out on his way. No, instead it is that powerful reminder to us that God does not call people that we think are qualified to do it. God doesn't call the people that we look at and go, "Man, that's the one that should be the leader. That's the one that should be the one spreading God's message. That's the one that should be definitely trying to show us all the better way." God doesn't pick them. That's not the ones he decided on. Rather, God qualifies his call. By the very fact that he chooses us means that we are qualified in his eyes. And he wants us to do it. It is this remarkable moment when we come face to face with the reality that maybe we didn't always make the best decisions. Maybe we did fall in with the wrong crowd. Maybe we got distracted along the way and started running with the wrong group. Maybe in some way we recognize just how wayward the world around us has gotten. And I'm always amazed. People tell me regularly, they say, "I just wish God would appear to me and just tell me what he wanted. You know, just part the clouds and tell me what's going on and then we'll be all set." And I think to myself, I don't really think you want that. Because every person who has ever had that experience ever always says, "Now I'm going to die." It's not as gentle as it reads in Scripture. There's a terrifying moment when your heart stops and all kinds of terror is around. Because the presence of God is not just some warm, fuzzy feeling, but truly the presence of the Almighty. And God calls us. He may not have to give us a vision of the temple. He may not give us a giant catch of fish. realize that Peter at no time decided that because he caught this great catch of fish that his luck was just turning around on him. He didn't think, wow, life's just coming on the upswing for me, so now I just gotta ride this train for a while. No, he saw grace in action. And he realized that he needed to be something better. God calls each and every one of us. Maybe not always in such loud terms. Maybe not always in such drastically sky-splitting sort of ways. But think about it. Even St. Paul in the Corinthians points out, he says, look, Jesus appeared to all these very important people. Cephas, the leader, the 12, 500, James, all of the apostles. I mean, look at all these very important people that he appears to. And then, like an abnormal one, he appeared to me. God calls each of us. Sometimes a little more strongly than others, sometimes a little more loudly worded than others, but what we must never underestimate is that in this invitation we have a genuine opportunity to see that the world around us maybe is not the perfect world it should be. And perhaps we are not quite as holy as we think we ought to be. But I assure you that each and every one of us is tasked with the responsibility of being that witness of God to others, of being that light to a world otherwise consumed by darkness, by being, in so many ways, the one who responds to God's invitation. The challenge falls to each of us when God looks out and he asks, who will I send? Are we going to close our eyes and cross our fingers and hope that God picks somebody else? Or can we be bold enough? Can we be brave enough? Can we be willing, not qualified, just willing, to step forward and say, here I am, Lord. Send me.